funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why are the stories of Greek and Roman mythology still with us thousands of years after they were first told? And what inspired such marvelous tales of power, sex, and intrigue? My guest today spent his boyhood thrilling to the adventures of the mighty Zeus, the enchanting Aphrodite, and the heroes, monsters, and warriors that populated their world. Only in researching the stories as an adult did he realize how much of the juicy stuff was left out of those childhood versions, so he set about to recreate them for a 21st century audience of grown-ups, with all the details that have been captivating listeners and then readers for hundreds of generations. Philip Freeman is professor of classics and chair of the classics department at Luther College in Iowa. His new book is called Oh My Gods, a modern retelling of Greek and Roman myths. Philip, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much.
So I remember the original stories as being pretty intense, but I'm quite sure that what I read in seventh grade was not as wild as what I read over the past couple of days in your book. What do we miss out on if we are only familiar with the Baudelaireized versions of these stories?
Well, you miss the stories as they were really written by the Greeks and the Romans, too. You miss out on a lot of sex, a lot of violence, and a lot of very disturbing stories.
And what kind of source material is available for you to work with, given that there was never an officially approved canon for these stories?
Right. So what I had to do is go back to the original Greek, the different authors like Homer and Hesiod and Sophocles and some of the Latin authors like Ovid, and go back and look at the original Greek and Latin, and then take those stories and those varieties of stories and pull them together and put them into a modern version for grown-ups, as you said.
Do we understand the original language any better than, say, Edith Hamilton did 100 years ago?
Oh, there are small advances here and there, but really, Greek and Latin have been well-known for 2,000 years, and Edith Hamilton, who wrote the classic work, Mythology, that's still read in schools, in which I recommend to everybody, she was a very good classical scholar, but she was the headmistress of a school for girls and wrote a book for them. And so naturally it's a very sanitized version of Greek mythology.
How did the accounts differ from one another? When you look at different things that have been written down over time, what sorts of details do you find in conflict?
Well, you have, for one thing, for example, is you have different creation stories. Hmm. The Greeks were not at all troubled by having multiple versions of creation. So in some stories you have Zeus create people. In other stories it's Prometheus. Those are the different versions, and that's a good example of what I have to do in the book. Is I either try to take multiple stories and strain one version out of them, or what I very often do is just say, some people say this, other people say that. It really depends.
And it shouldn't surprise people that you, of course, start the book with the creation story, and it is every bit as lyrical and magical as what we hear from a lot of currently practiced religious texts.
Yes, the first line of the book, in the beginning there was chaos, which I borrow shamelessly from the book of Genesis, but it's true. In Greek mythology, that's how it begins, with this great yawning chasm called chaos, from which spring the primordial gods like Earth and Eros and Tartarus. And it goes on from there, and you have different generations of gods who come along. You have Earth and the first generation, and then you have the Titans who come along. And then third generation is when you finally get to Zeus and Hera and the rest.
And from the beginning, they are pretty much constantly in conflict.
Oh, they're always fighting. When Earth was born out of chaos, she gave birth to Sky, who became her mate. And they had children together, but Sky was jealous of these children. He didn't like them anyway, so he shoved them back into Earth. And Earth didn't like that. The children didn't like that. And so Earth convinced her youngest son, Kronos, to rise up against their father. One night when Sky came to lie with Earth, Kronos reaches up and castrates his father. And it's quite a violent and graphic story, but it's just the first of a number of different quarrels and vicious battles between the different generations of the gods.
So Cronus is a terrible son, but he is unquestionably maybe the worst father in mythological or real history.
Yes, what Cronus does, and it's when you have violence in families, unfortunately, it's sometimes repeated over generations, so that when Cronus had children and his wife gave birth to them, he swallowed them himself. And so all of the different children, like Hera and Poseidon, as soon as they were born, he swallowed, until the last one came along, who was Zeus, and Cronus is tricked into swallowing a stone instead of swallowing Zeus. So Zeus gets to go away to Crete and grow up and eventually come back and fight and overthrow his father Cronus.
Let's talk about the word myth, because the way we use it today is actually very different from its original meaning.
Yes, originally it was a story. A mythos is just a story, and it's a word that occurs all over the place in Greek literature. And it doesn't mean a story that's not true. It just means a story. It usually means a story with some significant meaning to it. And that's how we, in scholarly circles, in colleges, and universities, how it's usually used. If I call something a myth, it doesn't mean that it didn't happen. The story of the Titanic, the sinking of the Titanic, is something that really happened, but it's also a wonderful myth because it has great examples of human emotion and human frailty in it. So a myth is really just a story that has some significant meaning to it.
Who was responsible for preserving and sharing these stories in ancient Greece and Rome?
Oh, all sorts of people. The first ones who were the poets. There were professional classes of poets like Homer, like the Greek poet Hesiod, who told these stories and what they would do, and they were professionals. You would pay them. So if you had a wedding, if you had a party, you would come, and in the evening the poet would stand up with his harp around the fire and sing you the tales of Troy or of Oedipus. And so the poets really at first preserved the myths, but then later on the myths were preserved by different authors in Alexandria, Egypt, and Athens, and Rome. Ovid, the Roman poet Ovid, is really one of our best preservers of mythology. He lived in the first century, and he gave us so many of the myths that we have today.
It's so interesting, Philip, to think about this, that you know, today we run to our novels and our movies and our TV shows, and our ancestors did the same with the technology that was available to them. We have always longed to hear stories bigger and more exciting than our own lives. What do you think that, why do you think that is?
Well, stories are, I don't know is the short answer, mm-hmm. but stories appeal to people in a way that nothing else does. I know when I teach in my college classes, if I notice that people are starting to nod off, all of a sudden I'll say, you know, that reminds me of a story. And you can see people just perk up and listen. There's something absolutely innate in human nature that makes us love stories. And so this is well known by any teacher. If you tell a story, people will listen to you.
So is it possible to say what was gained and perhaps what was lost when written versions began to exist alongside those which were presented orally to people?
Well, when stories were written down, such as Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, they became standardized to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. And a number of the oral versions that were floating around were lost once there became a written standard. So I guess a certain amount of variety, a certain amount of creativity died when stories were first written down.
So was Homer the author of the Iliad and the Odyssey, or did he take existing tradition and put it into a written form?
Well, that's a great question. People have been arguing whether or not Homer wrote the Iliad and the Odyssey, whether or not he composed it orally, whether there was more than one Homer, whether Homer was a woman. The general consensus at the moment is that he was an oral poet living right at the cusp of literacy. And so he composed these stories drawing on material centuries old. And put it down in a form that was very soon thereafter recorded in writing, which was a fairly new development in Greece at his time.
Talk a little bit about how mythology was used by the ancient Greeks. Was it something, I mean, obviously there are some morality tales here. I'm also curious about, were these stories meant to inspire worship or devotion?
Well, they had all sorts of different usages. The Romans, for example, used mythology as propaganda. Roman mythology, if you read it, it's very different from the Greeks. Everything about it seems to be about the service to the state and sacrifice of the individual. So there's a propaganda use. But mythology was also used in ritual. It was used in teaching, in the time of life where young men and boys and girls become young men and women. There were initiation rites that mythology was certainly used in. It was also used just as plain entertainment, and it was also used to explain things. Up here in Iowa right now, it's below zero. You have snow all over the ground, and it's freezing. And you wonder, why does it get cold in the winter? Well, there's a myth to explain that, the story of Persephone going down into the underworld for a third of the year. So the mythology has all sorts of different usages and all sorts of different motivations behind it.
Hmm. I suppose you in Iowa would love to have a guarantee that only a third of the year is going to be cold and miserable.
Yes, that would be nice. But we do have lots of water up here.
And it's not surprising that Poseidon, speaking of water, was a very important god to Assyria. Seafaring people.
Oh, yes. The Greeks, if anybody's been to Greece, they know that it is a very mountainous area, some parts of which were only reached by roads 50 years ago. So the sea was the connecting force in ancient Greece. So Poseidon, naturally enough, becomes very important. And anybody who's ever sailed the wine dark seas of the Aegean in a storm knows that you want to say a few prayers to the god who's in charge of that before you set out.
Now, these were not stories that the Greeks in their worship of the gods were necessarily required to accept as truth. They were designed to let the Greeks know how the gods might interact with them. Is that accurate?
Right, I think so. The Greek religion, and this is something that we always talk about in my classes in mythology and religion up here in college. The Greeks looked at religion differently than most modern people do. They looked at the gods differently. Those of us who were raised in Judeo-Christian tradition, we look at God, we look at Jesus as an example for our own lives. But the Greeks would have never looked at the gods as moral examples for how to live their lives. The gods were forces of nature. They had power. You worked out a deal with them. You made a sacrifice, and hopefully the gods would be kind to you, and your harvest would be good that year. So it's a very different world, the Greeks and Romans, from what most people would think of as religion today.
Yes, you know, some of these stories, Philip, are such cautionary tales that they almost make me feel like the sort of culture we have today of celebrity, where we look at, say, a Charlie Sheen and say, don't let this happen to you. Even though he's elevated in some ways above the average person, we can still realize that that is not a path we want to follow.
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the great things about mythology for us today, is we can look at these stories and we can learn something about how to apply them to our own lives. The myth of Narcissus is a classic example. He falls in love with his own reflection, which for any of us is a very dangerous and easy thing to happen. So all of these myths, you can learn about modesty, you can learn about love, you can learn about relationships, you can learn about friendship, you can learn about facing death. These myths can teach all of us something.
I think it's interesting that sometimes the moral seems to simply be that the cleverest one wins.
Yes, it's true. Prometheus is just a wonderful example of this god who's not nearly as powerful as Zeus, but he keeps tricking him. And there are other stories, too, where you have humans who are the smartest, like Odysseus and the marvelous story of the Odyssey, who is just simply smarter than everybody else. And therefore, he comes out on top in the end.
Philip Freeman is my guest. He's professor of classics and chair of the classics department at Luther College in Iowa. His new book is called Oh My Gods, a modern retelling of Greek and Roman myths. If you have a question from your days of reading these in school or maybe recently, or if you'd like to join the conversation with an observation, give us a call now. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Philip Freeman. He's professor of classics and chair of the classics department at Luther College in Iowa. His new book is called Oh My Gods, a modern retelling of Greek and Roman myths. Join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Philip, for better and quite often for worse, the Greeks were not an isolated people. They had a great deal of contact with other societies. What sort of interplay was there between Greek mythology and that of the other countries and people from other countries that they would have done business with?
Well, the Greeks, as we said before, were great people of the sea, and so they sailed all over the Mediterranean. They came into contact with Egyptians, with Phoenicians, with the different peoples of Asia Minor, the people to the west, the Romans, the Celts, the Iberians. And so the Greeks would have borrowed, and we know they did borrow, a lot of their stories, from especially from Africa and from the Near East. The creation stories, for example, are very much like those that we find in Babylonian literature. And there are a number of different myths, such as those of Demeter, which are very similar to Egyptian myths. So the Greeks were quite good at borrowing and transforming these different stories to fit their own culture.
It's remarkable that flood mythology also seems to be around from a large amount of cultures in the ancient world.
Yes, you get stories. You get the well. In the Epic of Gilgamesh, you get the story of Utnapishtim and Gilgamesh in talking about the great flood. Then in Greek mythology, you have a flood story. Of course, in the Hebrew Bible, you have the story of Noah. So they're quite similar to each other in many ways, but they're also different in some and also in some very interesting ways from each other.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones now to Maggie in Fort Worth. Hello, Maggie.
Hello. Interesting conversation, as usual.
Oh, thank you.
And I think your guest touched on something that I came across in graduate school, and I found liberating and very interesting as for looking at this kind of topic. Lyotard wrote an essay called The Postmodern Condition, a Report on Knowledge. And the part in that that struck me the most was how he talked about storytelling and cultures and privileging the storytellers. And in pre-literate cultures, the storyteller had an important role. The stories, the myths, whatever the content was largely a teaching tool, a reminder how to behave. Trickster stories in American Indian cultures didn't mean you should behave in this way. It's saying, look at what happens when you misbehave. There's a component of this, I think, that is largely present in many religions. I find it distressing in this day and age that some religions have chosen to ignore that teaching aspect, and they treat these stories very literally. And you lose the meaning and you lose perspective when you look at the Bible as literal word of God versus a way to teach a culture how to get along and behave.
What's your take on that, Philip?
Well, it's a very good point. The Greeks certainly never would have looked at their own stories literally. They were a lot of them were cautionary tales. They were example tales. You get a lot of figures, a lot of humans and gods in Greek mythology who nobody would want to be like. But they're important trickster figures, absolutely. You get just a lot of really bad guys in there. So I think it's a very good point.
Hades is a fascinating character, not necessarily associated with evil, but certainly with death and all of the sorrow that brings with it.
Yes, we know Hades is, in spite of everybody, what everybody's seen in the Disney movie Hercules, Hades was not a bad guy at all. He one time kidnapped Persephone, but that's really about the only myth we have concerning him. He was, again, a force of nature. He was death personified, and when it came time for somebody to die, they went down to the realm of Hades. He wasn't ever thought of as an evil god, certainly.
Really interesting to look at the sexual fluidity that's displayed here. From the beginning, there are stories here of heterosexuals and there are stories of homosexual sex. What's interesting to me is that, at least in reading your book, it doesn't seem like anybody is ever exclusively homosexual in this mythology.
Right. It's a fascinating, and it's not just in Greek mythology, but in ancient Greek culture, they had a very different view of sexual identity than most modern people would. They would never classify somebody as heterosexual, homosexual, bisexual. It just would not have occurred to them. And so you have Zeus, who has a lot of female partners, a lot of female victims, really, in a lot of ways, but he also has a number of male lovers, like Ganymede. And so this was just considered normal in Greek mythology and in Greek culture. It's a very complicated sort of concept, but and it varied according to time and place, but the Greeks looked at sexuality certainly very differently than we do.
There is a great deal of rape in these stories. I mean, are we to believe that the Greeks were very sexually violent?
Well, I think that's I think it plays on what the previous caller said. Zeus and Poseidon, I mean, to put it frankly, are serial rapists. And I don't think that we're supposed to believe that this is how Greeks generally behaved. I mean, certainly there was rape in ancient Greek culture. There was everywhere. But this was not that some sort of an example for how people were supposed to live. It was a violent culture. It was a culture where just about every male had been in battle at some point or another. And so I think it's just a reflection of a very tense and violent sort of way of life.
What can we learn about the way the Greeks viewed sexual equality and gender rights when we look at the very strong, in many cases, goddess figures here?
Yes. I mean, the one thing I tried to do in my book is to bring out more stories of goddesses, more stories of women. And so we get a number of very strong female figures, divine and human, in Greek mythology. Hera is a great example, the wife and sister of Zeus. Aphrodite is the goddess of love and sex, is not at all shy about expressing herself. Artemis, Artemis and Athena, both virgin goddesses, very tough, very smart. And then we have heroes, such as the wonderful story of Atalanta, mm-hmm. who doesn't want to get married. And she races men who want to marry her. She beats them, and then they get killed as part of the losing. So there's some absolutely marvelous stories of women, female figures in Greek mythology.
There was a sort of magic associated with female virgins, but no such magic associated with male virgins?
No, they're really not. It's just not something that comes up, at least not very often, in Greek mythology.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phones to Tom in Dallas. Hello, Tom.
Good afternoon, Chris, and your guest. You haven't mentioned Egyptian mythology during this interview, and I was wondering how close the Egyptian mythology was to the Roman and Greek mythology. It seems to me there's quite a bit of identical mythology in the three cultures.
Well, there certainly was a lot of borrowing from classical mythology, from Egyptian mythology into classical mythology. The book itself doesn't deal with Egyptian mythology particularly because it's such a huge subject. And covers thousands of years in Egypt. But you're right that there was a great deal of communication, a great deal of story borrowing across these different cultures.
We have an email here from Ellis in North Dallas who writes, can you think of any more melodramatic family saga than that of the House of Atreus that contains everything from cannibalism to sacrifice of a child by Agamemnon to having the gods have winds to start a 10-year war with Troy?
Yes, I mean, the House of Atreus is the ultimate dysfunctional family. They, in cannibalism, not just once, but multiple times throughout five generations. Murder, sexual abuse, it's a horrible situation, culminating Well, with the Trojan War, and then the return of Agamemnon and his murder by Clytemnestra, and then a few more murders after that. So it's just, if you think your life is bad, you will feel so much better after you read about the House of Atreus.
Ancient soap opera.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to wonder, especially in terms of the monsters, what these guys were smoking.
Well, the monsters are great in Greek mythology. The chimera, the different creatures that Perseus faces. Monsters are just a wonderful feature of mythology around the world, and whatever else they are, they are an embodiment, I think, of our fears and overcoming the fears and difficulties of life. So, no, there's some great monsters.
And many times in those monster stories, there's a trick to it. So if you sort of know the secret, you'll be okay.
Yes. Well, when Hercules starts wrestling with this giant, Antaeus, and the trick is, in order to beat this giant, you have to lift him off the ground and separate him from his mother Earth. So, and Theseus goes through a whole bunch of different adventures where he kills either a bad guy or a monster by knowing the trick. Cleverness is certainly a part of beating monsters.
We have an email here, this one from Nick in Dallas, who writes, because life and professions have changed so significantly from the time of the Greeks, which stories did you have the most difficulty transferring to modern relevant terms? We should say here, these are not 21st century iterations of these stories, but I wonder if the question is still valid for you.
Yeah, it is. What I did is I just tried to simply tell the stories as they are in the original sources. So I didn't, translate them and make Zeus a 21st century guy at all. But it's hard for us modern people to put ourselves into the place of some of these stories and to understand what it's like to be Penelope waiting at home for 20 years for your husband to come home. Or maybe it's not so hard. I've talked to a lot of veterans from Iraq and from Afghanistan. And they say that these stories, the stories of fighting in the Trojan War, the stories, the difficulties of returning home, are so spot on to what is still going on. So transferring these stories or telling these stories, it's really not that difficult for people to relate to them.
I don't know if you have kids, but certainly you might have undergrads young enough to be familiar with the work of people like Rick Riordan. And I wonder what you think about those sorts of stories as an entree into reading more classical accounts.
Well, I do have kids. I have a 13-year-old and a 14-year-old.
Okay.
And they, of course, grew up reading all sorts of Percy Jackson and all the rest. And I think the Percy Jackson, the series especially, does a pretty good job of telling these stories, and the movies too, for that matter. I mean, sure, they change things; they have to. But I think they do a good job. And I mean, you could quibble if you look at the some of the movies that have come out, like Wrath of the Titans, and you could quibble quite a bit about those. They certainly venture pretty far from the originals. But I think, if nothing else, the explosion of movies about the ancient world, mythological, historical, whatever, show the ongoing interest of these stories to children and to adults today.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Ken in Plano. Hello, Ken.
Yes, hi. I'm so glad we had this previous caller. I wasn't going to call in and ask this, but now I am. The God of Abraham, which most of us worship, from one book to the next, from one testament to the next, his character kind of changes. His sort of personality changes from one story to the next. I'm trying to be nice about it, but to what degree do these important figures in Greek mythology, their inherent personalities change? Is there a sort of an equilibrium from one story to the next, their personalities, their characteristics?
Well,
thank you.
In some ways, they pretty much stay the same. The Zeus that we see back in the creation stories is the same Zeus that we see centuries later. And yet the Greeks struggled with this, too. You had a lot of Greek, especially intellectuals, who were really troubled with the behavior of these gods. And so there were efforts to change these stories and to make them maybe a little bit more acceptable. You're right. You can see a certain evolution of characters at least a different emphasis of characters throughout the centuries.
Do Do you find any relationship between the behavior of the gods and goddesses and, say, Greek tyrants and monarchs?
Yeah, well, that's a good point. The Greeks, in general, did not like tyrants. There's lots of exceptions to that. But, I think the stories in Greek mythology, one thing that they can teach you is that if you have a tyrant, you have an absolute ruler, you can have problems that come up with the abuse of power. And so, I think you could read a good many of these myths as political and cultural commentaries.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Sarah in Plano. Hello, Sarah.
Hi. I love this topic, so thank you. I grew up on these stories, more like censored versions of the stories, and it kind of shaped my worldview to where, you know, no one is perfectly good and no one is perfectly evil, like not even the gods are perfectly good or perfectly evil. And I wonder how that, like, reflects on Greek culture versus, like, our culture, where there are, like, perfectly good people who are saints and perfectly evil people who are, like, devils or whatever, and kind of how that plays into that. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, it's a good question. The Greeks certainly reflect the good and the bad. You look at Zeus, you look at Poseidon. There's really a lot more bad there than there is good, but there's some good, too. And so I think it makes the gods a lot more human. Some of our characters today, saints who are pure, are not very interesting, really. The most interesting saints, like St. Patrick or any others, are the ones who have struggled and sinned in order to get where they are. So I think that's one thing that's so appealing about these heroes and these gods, is that they have serious faults going on, and so we can relate to them a whole lot better.
Philip Freeman is my guest. He's professor of classics and chair of the classics department at Luther College in Iowa. We're talking this hour about his new book. It's called Oh My Gods, a modern retelling of Greek and Roman myths. If you'd like to join the conversation, we have a couple of lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also get to us by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Philip Freeman is my guest. He's chair of the Classics Department and professor of classics at Luther College in Iowa. His new book is called Oh My Gods, a modern retelling of Greek and Roman myths. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Philip, these stories remain such a part not only of our culture, but our language. We have so many expressions based on these tales. I wonder how often you find that we get things wrong. For example, the Pandora's box that we all know was in fact a bottle.
It was. It was actually a large jar. And archaeologists have found these all over the Greek world, these pithoi is what they were. These enormous jars, and somehow this got mistranslated with the story of Pandora, so she doesn't actually open a box, but she takes the lid off of a jar and lets all the evils out into the world.
It doesn't really change the nature of the story, but it's funny to think that we have that so wrong.
Oh, it is. And one of the many reasons for reading mythology is cultural literacy. Mm-hmm. And once you read about it, you learn about so many different words and stories. Tantalize. We all use the word tantalize. If you read mythology, you learn it comes from this guy named Tantalus, who was punished in Hades by never being able to reach fruit that was hanging over his head, or able to drink from the water that was beneath him. I was watching Jon Stewart the other night, and they were talking about Sisyphus pushing a boulder up a hill.
Mm-hmm.
Reading mythology really helps you understand so many of these references.
Yeah, I remember in the 80s when the Police song Message in a Bottle came out, I was really proud that I knew what Charybdis and the Scylla were.
Yes, absolutely. And you can impress people. Instead of saying you're stuck between a rock and a hard place, say, oh, I feel like I'm stuck between Scylla and Charybdis today. So that's a lot of fun.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Jack on the line now in Dallas. Hey, Jack.
Yes, great program. Thank you.
Thank you.
Earlier, you referenced the parallels between some of our creation stories and the stories of the Great Flood. Most of our major religions also have apocalyptic end-time stories. Just wondering if there are any parallels to that kind of thinking in early Greek mythology.
You know, there are. There is in the early Greek poet Hesiod. He talks about the world coming to an end. He talks about how children will turn against their parents. About how family structure will fall apart. It sounds very much like some of the things that Jesus says in the Gospels. So there's not a lot of that end time, that sort of eschatology in Greek mythology, but there is some, and the parallels of it to other religious cultures are quite amazing.
I guess once again, it reflects, you know, a pretty universal fear of a world that looks this way.
Yes, I mean, you look at, oh goodness, Norse mythology, and you have Ragnarok, you have the end of the great battle at the end of the world, where all the gods and heroes are going to die. It's it truly is. Some of these features, the creation, the end of the world, are practically universal.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Jamshid on the line now in Plano. Hi, Jamshid.
Hi. Thank you very much for answering. I have a question. There is an anthropologist by the name of Zachariah Sitchin. And Zachariah Sitchin is the one who actually discovered Troy. So my question is, if the Troy was a myth, if you discover it, is it still a myth?
Well, archaeologists, I was at Troy about a year and a half ago with a bunch of my students. Troy is real. It's there. You can have a real place, and you can, like the archaeologists, have found evidence of battles and wars at Troy. You can have something that's real that can still be a myth. I talked about the Titanic earlier. There is not necessarily a relationship between myth and history.
I thought it was interesting that you point out that the Romans, as they came along and sort of co-opted some of these myths for their own use, identified themselves with the Trojans.
Yes, it is. It's fascinating that the Romans, who are these great, powerful people, said that they were descended from the losers of the Trojan War. But they wanted to tie themselves into the whole epic cycle, and so they did.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to John in Dallas. Hello, John.
Hello. I wanted to ask, do you think there is, to some extent, some of our modern literature that is already in the process of becoming some mythology that maybe 1,000 years later some other culture will refer to? Hmm. Thanks.
That's a great question. But I look at Tolkien and The Lord of the Rings, and I wonder, you know, that's become so much a part, or Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the Star Wars movies, and you know, it's practically a part of our DNA now. You can talk, you know, pull any line out of Star Trek, and people will know. So, you know, I wonder what's going to be around 1,000 years from now, too. Is it going to be Joyce's Ulysses? Is it going to be Tolkien? Is it going to be Harry Potter? I don't know. It's so hard to predict which are the myths that are going to last. But they will be the myths that appeal fundamentally to our human nature.
It seems that, you know, if you talk about Tolkien or Star Wars, at least, these are things that came to us feeling like myth, as opposed to stories of everyday life, which may be important and even transcendent, but don't quite have that extra something to them.
That's true. And when you had Tolkien, who was, you know, a professor of literature, he knew these myths inside and out. You have George Lucas, who very deliberately plays on mythological themes with Star Wars. So I mean, it is different from just sort of everyday stories. So you know, I would love to know which of the myths that are current today, being created today, that will survive 1,000 years from now, if any,
or what people will say they reflect about our culture.
Oh, absolutely,
accurately or not.
Yes.
Let's go next on the phones to Pamela in Dallas. Hey, Pamela.
Hi. I have a question that came to mind when an earlier caller asked about the influence of Egyptian mythology on Greek mythology.
Mm-hmm.
And I specifically wanted to ask your guest about the myth of Oedipus and the pharaoh Akhenaten. I read this wonderful book by Emmanuel Velikovsky called Oedipus and Akhenaten, in which he theorizes that the Greek myth of Oedipus came from the Egyptian history of the sort of heretical pharaoh Akhenaten, and I'd just like to hear what he has to say about that.
Are you familiar with the theory, Philip?
Well, no, I'm not. I don't know of that book. I mean, it's a fascinating idea. So on that specific question, I don't have a good answer. But there was certainly a lot of borrowing from Egypt by the Greeks, absolutely.
You know, what's really interesting about your field of study, Philip, in the classics, is that unlike someone who is working in the sciences or many other fields, you can really draw on things that are 1,000 years old, whereas no one would take a science text from 300 years ago and apply it to what they're working on today.
Yeah, and I also have a lot of job security because Greek and Latin are not likely to change a lot before I retire. And so, you know, anybody out there looking for a secure job, if they can find one, Greek and Latin is for you.
The liberal arts are coming back.
They are.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We now have Pam on the line in Dallas. Hey, Pam.
Good afternoon. Can the guest comment on the Odyssey as the genesis of the road trip story? And what recent movies are his favorite retellings of the Odyssey?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. Yeah, the Odyssey certainly is the original road trip, even though it's mostly by boat. But I look at movies like Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, a marvelous retelling of the Odyssey. You know, that, I think that's probably my favorite. I would recommend to anybody to go out and see. But if you are interested, if you just have time to read one myth or one book, I definitely recommend the Odyssey to anybody. It's absolutely marvelous. I've read it 20 times in Greek and 20 times in English, and it gets better every time.
You have a favorite English translation for people who might feel intimidated?
Well, I think the Fagles translation is quite good. The Lattimore translation is good, too. The Fagles is the one that I use in my mythology classes, and it's quite wonderful.
Is all this still being taught to children in, you know, K-12 education today?
Oh, yeah. I just a few months ago went and talked to a ninth grade classroom. I talked to fourth graders. Mythology is very much a part of the curriculum because for 1,000 reasons it should be, but for one reason is kids love it.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're, you know, want to get your kids interested in mythology, there are a number of good books out there. There's a children's version of my own book coming out in May, an illustrated children's version. So there are a lot of resources out there for kids interested in mythology.
So this is a children's version of Oh My Gods?
It is. It's called Heroes of Olympus, and I just saw the proofs of it. It looks really pretty good.
With a lot of the sex taken back out.
Oh, yes, absolutely. this is made for people in elementary and middle school, yeah.
What are our kids' favorite characters, do you find?
Well, they love Hercules, mm-hmm. Of course, fighting all the monsters. And they don't need to know some of the bad things that Hercules did. But I think Hercules is definitely one of the favorites. Odysseus fighting the Cyclops and all of that are also quite popular. Stories that there's a lot of good stories, like we mentioned Atalanta earlier, that appeal to girls. A lot of these myths are really quite appealing, I think, to girls and to women. They have a lot to say.
So you leave out the Gorgons, perhaps, as well.
Yeah, some of them are not that great, but there's some wonderful, strong female characters in Greek mythology and Roman mythology too.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Bill on the line in Dallas. Hey, Bill.
Hi. My question is about the Greek philosophers, about the Stoics, about the writings of Plato and Aristotle. How did the Greek myths either make it more likely that philosophical thought would develop, or maybe make it harder?
Well, that's a great question. The Stoics were this school of Greek philosophy, and they certainly did not reject Greek mythology. They interpreted it a little bit differently, looked at it more symbolically. Plato and Aristotle also did not reject Greek mythology. Plato actually makes up some wonderful myths of his own. So I don't think that the intellectual side of Greek culture really fought against the mythological side at all. I think they worked together pretty well.
When you go back and read the source texts, obviously you're working with the original language. I wonder how in your mind you sort of translate not only words that are different, obviously, but different ways of explaining things, different metaphors, and how you incorporate that into your retelling.
Yeah, that is hard. You get a Greek word. Well, I always tell my students in first year Greek that the Greeks had multiple words for love.
Mm.
And eros is one of those, which we get our word erotic from, for example. And eros really means sex. It doesn't mean love. And so when you're telling a story and you have the word eros come up, what I tried to do in this book, at least, is translate it as sex, unless there's some great reason for translating it otherwise. So, I mean, it's one of the difficulties whenever you're translating a text or retelling a story is you can never get it quite right because between cultures, you always lose something.
What was the standard of beauty? I mean, would someone who was very beautiful in ancient Greece still be viewed as very beautiful today, or did they have different things that they valued?
Well, the standards seem to be fairly similar when you look at descriptions of Helen of Troy,
mm-hmm.
or you look at the goddess Aphrodite when she becomes when she dresses up as a mortal to seduce a young man named Anchises. The standards really seem to be quite similar. Just pretty much any supermodel would be a great fit to play Helen.
Does any of the stuff ever find its way into your dreams at night?
My personal dreams?
Uh-huh.
Well, yeah. I mean, I do. I don't dream about Greek gods and heroes every night, but sure, there are plenty of occasions where I will think of Greek mythology and Carl Jung would probably have a field day with some of these dreams, but sure, I've read these so much that I think about them, I do dream about them sometimes.
Well, it's got to be exciting anyway.
Oh, it is.
Philip Freeman is professor of classics and chair of the classics department at Luther College in Iowa. His new book is called Oh My Gods, a modern retelling of Greek and Roman myths. And Philip, remind us again of the title of the kids' version that is forthcoming.
It will be called Heroes of Olympus, and it should be out May 1st.
Super. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. You can email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.